Okay, hi everybody, this is Addison Schoenland, and welcome to today's Perspectives. Today we're talking about The Outsiders, which is a friendly way of describing COMAC in China and UAC in Russia. Next slide, please. So what we want to do today is you're going to hear some expert perspective and assess the impact of new disruptive technologies, ask our panel questions, and then obviously the purpose of this webinar is to promote discussion about the future of aviation.
I think we should probably hold on for a couple more people, Addison, and let some more people come in.
We're pretty active right now. The audience is pretty active.
Oh, okay. I can't see how many we have.
Okay. Our speakers today, Ernie, are Ernie Arvai. I'm not going to dwell too much on his background. You've very familiar with him. And Michelle Merlozo, also well known to the audience. And what we want to do is start with the session. I need the next slide. You know who I am. Okay, so what we want to have is perspectives on UAC and COMAC. We're going to talk some about flight test progress, and then, of course, we'll have the industry and geopolitical challenges. So, gentlemen, Ernie, how about you take the first start?
All right, thank you. Thank you, Addison. Good morning. We'd like to start with the aircraft, well, now called MC-21, but really Magistrengi Samulot for mainline aircraft for the 21st century. It was designed, and the S in Russia has been, which looks like a C in the Cyrillic alphabet, has been now marketed as MC-21 internationally. So a little bit of transliteration that didn't occur, but there we are. The MC-21 was an all-new mainline aircraft designed for the Russian market, but it was designed around the Pratt & Whitney GTF engines and Western avionics and Western components. It has a composite wing. It's lightweight, lighter than the competing A320neo or 737 MAX. And with the Pratt, has great economic performance. It is actually better in terms of seat mile economics and aircraft mile economics than A320neo and the MAX, MAX 8. The performance and target range targets have been met in the test flights. It had Western components and was ready to export with some world-class partners on the program, but U.S. economic sanctions put a stop to that plan. There was always a backup plan to have a Russian engine, and that's the Aviat Vigatel PD-14 to replace the GTF. It's not quite as efficient as the Pratt. It's about 6 to 8% loss in fuel economy over the GTF, but it's still a strong performing engine, and that puts the aircraft still in better shape than the A320ceo and the 737NG. And given the aerodynamic improvements on the airplane, it comes very close to the Neo and Max, but not quite there. But the Russian components will replace the Western components that have been blocked, and the supply chain is gearing up in Russia with to support the program with local vendors. The new model will be the MC-21-310 will be the model for the Russian market. The 300 with the Pratt & Whitney will probably just have the test airplanes unless there's a change in economic sanctions. The airplane is still a viable competitor. It should be strong in the Russian market. Firm orders stand at 175 aircraft currently, with Aeroflot to be the launch customer for the aircraft. The program status, the four flight test aircraft, all GTF powered in existence today. The PD-14 test aircraft is almost ready. They're going through a lot of the testing. You can see the water ingestion tests on the right side, and the photo were completed in August. Certification next year, late next year, maybe early 2022, depends on what happens with the engines and if anything changes with sanctions after the U.S. elections. Testing continues, and some of these tests will be probably okay for certification of the airplane with the other engines. So they're not going to lose a lot of time on the program with that. It's just a matter of whether the PD-14 will be on time or not. So what's the end result? Well, the U.S. sanctions will turn around and aid Russia in developing its own engine industry. We think the learning from the PD-14 will help the PD-35, which will be the engine for the CR-929 widebody with China, assuming that joint venture, which has been a little shaky, goes through. This will, over the longer term, create more competition for both Boeing and Airbus, as well as competition for Pratt, GE, and Rolls-Royce, as the China-Russia bloc will likely order Russian engines. And there will still be some international markets for the airplane. Basically, those places that have been sanctioned by the U.S. So we expect the airplane to show up in Cuba, in Iran, and in North Korea, and in countries that have been basically blocked by the U.S. from buying new aircraft. The Iranian market is by far the largest. There's a need for at least 100 airplanes there. So as this airplane is completed with Russian components and becomes available, we would expect a sale to Iran, because they have a number of 40-year-old aircraft that they desperately need to replace. If we look at the long-term view, we know China has a long-term view, and Michelle will talk about that. The C-919 is a learning aircraft for them. With sanctions, the MS-21 has become the engine to really drive both the commercial aircraft and engine industry in Russia. They had a go at the westernization before with the Sukhoi Superjet. It really didn't work in terms of catching on in the West because of the lack of product support, despite the joint venture with Alenia. So Russia needs to focus on its core market, which is its own needs. Both aircraft will be viable competitors, the Russian version and the export version, if they get to make it. Competitors for the next generation of aircraft, and will take some market share away from Boeing within their respective spheres of influence. So with that, I'll turn it over to Michelle from AIR, who will talk a little bit about COMAC after his disclaimer, which we can allow you to read. Michelle, over to you.
Thank you, Ernie. I think by now most people are familiar with our disclaimer, which is kind of standard SOP these days, but I'll let you peruse for another few seconds. Right next to that picture, a fresh picture of a 919 taxiing out of Pudong Airport recently. Okay. Next slide, please.
There we go.
There we go. So as I have done before in previous events organized by Air Insight, I like to put things in perspective in terms of the long-term view for the company or issue that we're discussing. Today, I'd like us to again take the long view on what we expect COMAC in terms of execution, in terms of market share, where they stand in terms of performance, where they stand in terms of flight testing as well. So if we start with the upper left corner with the production, the expected production for COMAC to 2035, we can see that there is a fundamental sequencing of the performance of the company. We're going to be here under 90, 100 airplanes a year for production, mostly the C919 and the RJ21, of course, for quite some time. This is reflective of a company that is ramping up not just only its production capability, but the production system, working with the supply chain, whether it is the Western supply chain or transitioning to a more Chinese supply chain. And then eventually, as we enter the 2030s, you will see that there is a more rapid ramp up. This coincides with the introduction of the likely C919NG, what we call the NG variant of the 919, which is going to be an aircraft potentially with a new carbon composite wing in order to improve on its performance, and will also likely adapt a Chinese-built engine to replace or complement the CFM LEAP-X engine. And then we go into the 2030s, as you can see here, ramping up rapidly. That is the next generation of Chinese aircraft with an aircraft that we estimate is going to be more like the concept, the NMA concept that the Boeing company has put on ice for the time being. But fundamentally, a more Chinese-dominated market, especially into China in that period of time, versus here a slow ramp up and mixing of Airbus, Boeing, and COMAC products. Now, if we go to the chart on the right here, of course we're faced with a significant drop in production here that is COVID pandemic related. Of course, this does not affect COMAC the way it's been affecting Airbus or Boeing for quite obvious reasons. Well, we see, however, is that Airbus maintained its lead. There's a product gap at Boeing that may be driven by the absence of NMA, although we still think NMA as a justification to exist, more than a justification, by the way. And again, here you see the slow ramp up of COMAC into the 2030s. And I'm not suggesting any level of parity or any capability of COMAC to trail closely either Airbus or Boeing when they launch their next generation narrowbody aircraft around 2030, 2034. But we see definitely that COMAC is going to grab more market share, predominantly on the largest commercial aircraft market in the world, which is China. And that is going to have a multiplier effect on the ability of COMAC potentially to, you know, expand its production and its reach, sales reach into other territories. Of course, there are significant issues associated with potential regulatory certification, access to market, that Ernie and I will probably debate at some point in the Q&A section. So to provide you with a status of where we think the 919 is at this time. Of course, you've had a significant disruption of the flight test program earlier this year due to the emergence of the virus in Wuhan province and the slow propagation of the virus in the rest of China. But with a total of 6 test articles, we see that here on this chart, and I apologize for the small size, but we see that the number of test articles currently utilized by COMAC is stable at 6. That was the plan out of a 4,000 plus hours development time. We roughly estimate that this year COMAC is probably at around plus or minus, maybe minus 1,000 hours of flight tests with the 6 aircraft. I'll show some pictures recently of the hot and high testing in Turpin near Umrushi in Xinjiang province. But the fundamental issue here is next year's target, September, October target for an entry in service of the C919. We're not there yet. And if we follow the best case or the, you know, worst case scenario, we see that COMAC should be just about able to hit, you know, the timeline in late 2021. It's going to be a challenge. We're about 50 to 60% complete in the flight test program, but it remains to be seen whether or not they're going to be able to hit the numbers in 2021. Interestingly, you know, COMAC at their International Science and Technology Innovation Week last week. And I think it's a useful measure of really where the enterprise is focusing on recently. And that's got a lot to do with smart operations and smart manufacturing and establishing a service strategy for its commercial airline, aircraft portfolio, as well as looking at certification issue, which are a primary issue of concern with perhaps COMAC at this stage. But really to focus smart manufacturing, advanced industrial design, you know, a lot of emphasis on the integration of 5G technology, the integration of a supplier to OEM, you know, seamless 5G automation, digitization. I think it's safe to say that, you know, for COMAC, they're kind of working with a clean sheet of paper. Yes, granted, the ARJ21 is more 1970s, 80s design fundamentally. It's a legacy established by AVIC in China, in Shanghai, where the Douglas products were assembled. But it really, with the C919, which is also an aircraft rooted in the future and the past, there's the opportunity to establish a production system that has nothing to be ashamed of in terms of its integration and digitization compared with what you have at Boeing and Airbus. As Ernie was mentioning for the MS-21, the pending issue with COMAC is that of continuing access to Western engine technology, and that's an issue that has been concerning the Chinese, concerning COMAC, to the point that for the time being, they used to ask for export license for 2-3 items engine. Now they're asking for export license for a significant volume of engine at the same time in order to ensure proper supply downstream. At this point, I can't give you an exact number, but let's say it's in the upper hundreds of engine at the same time. There's still some issues, though, and very significant issues, I think, within COMAC. And that, I think, is to a degree similar to what Yakut is experiencing in the Russian Federation. There's one issue of culture. And that issue of culture applies not only to COMAC, but to the entire Chinese aerospace complex. You know, the Chinese aerospace industry has been very fragmented, and the consolidation of the AVICs and the consolidation of the design institute and the factories is still a work in progress. It's mined with provincial interest, it's mined with political interest, and that is something that is going to be affecting the performance of the Chinese industry deep into the 2030s for sure. Of course, there is also something that the Western industry has been able to more or less work around, since this issue of culture and this continuous feedback process within aerospace companies. In China, it doesn't work that way. It's a very hierarchical, it's very party-centered, and therefore, you know, the competences at the bottom of the pyramid that have sometimes few opportunities to provide feedback, to provide continuing improvement suggestions when the information migrate upwards. I think there's some improvement, but we're not there yet. And there is this issue with respect to what the perception of quality and what the perception of an acceptable work is for the supply chain. I think one of the great challenges that the Chinese supply chain is going to face is to really introduce this aerospace notion of quality, of zero default throughout the supply chain, throughout the companies that may not have had the same culture or the same expectations. Of course, we can talk about the party role, and that party role is integral to the enterprise. And we've seen recently that Chairman Xi Jinping has been very clear about increasing the voice and the role of the party in SMEs all the way to major SOEs, state-owned enterprises. So it really fundamentally affects the ability of a more rapid transition to a model that is more aligned with what we call Western model. The C919 flight test program continues, as I've said prior to this. Some issues, of course, autopilot, some nacelles vibration. They had to redesign the nacelles a couple of times. The structural issues with the flutter event that grounded the aircraft for a month and delamination of the horizontal stabilizer. These are, I believe, known issues. What is interesting is that when you have a new aircraft OEM like COMAC, it is challenging for suppliers, in that particular case, Western suppliers, to really work with COMAC with a good baseline of data so that they can provide a efficient solution to the OEM when the OEM itself has limited data and limited knowledge. You know, the OEM is always working on a baseline, a lighter aircraft, and then you start flight testing and reality strikes. In light of Made in China 2025, I think it is clear in my conversation with Chinese supply chain leaders over the course of 2019. Of course, we were hoping to attend the Shanghai Air Show at the end of November, but that looks like it's going to be very difficult to travel to China from the United States or Canada, at least. There is a definite effort to develop a proximity supply chain from Pudong, from the final assembly line. The flight testing program is distributed at four different locations, but the final assembly line is and will remain in the Pudong sector of the megapolis Shanghai. There's what they call the G60 Science and Technology Innovation Corridor, which is an effort by Chinese government and SOEs to really encourage the development of SMEs, of technology-driven companies who will focus primarily on the aerospace industry. That will take some time, take some effort. There's a lot of competition in the Shanghai area for talent, and COMAC has certainly been suffering from losing a significant number of engineers to emerging competing businesses like the electric car industry, which is absolutely booming in China. Next slide, Ernie. So this is a compendium of some recent pictures of progress of the final assembly line in Pudong, some of the pictures from last week, and all of this is public domain information. Of course, you just have to know where to find it. You can see that there's a high level of automation within the factory. You know, here and here you can see some of their partner Huawei is integral to COMAC's automation and supply chain tracking and visibility. The ARJ21 is a much more conventional production system. You can see on the right, you can see some picture of recent flight testing. This is test article number 2, I believe, 001 Charlie Turdan near Urumqi doing hot and high flight testing. You can see here the drogue chute deployed. That's a better way of mitigating load risk on the aircraft during stall testing in particular, and see the test crews here. This is probably test article 05 or 06 in its representative interior configuration. You got the test rig here as well. But that gives you an idea that, you know, they're making progress. They are slowly moving towards a better, I think, target for entry in service. But whatever our conclusion is at this point is when they enter service with 123 Airlines, OTT Airlines, that's an interesting name for an airline, and you get a lot of those in China, I must say. But when the C919 enters service with OTT Airlines, which is incidentally a subsidiary of China Eastern in, based out of Anshao in Shanghai, you will have a very, I would say, lab-like, very Yangtze Delta operation, you know, round trips, frequent round trips, to get a sense of how the aircraft is performing in service. But nothing truly representative in exploiting the capabilities of the aircraft for another 2 or 3 years after that. That's about it for me, Ernie. This is some information by AIR, but I think we can go into the Q&A portion of the webinar if you wish.
I think that's appropriate. And let me start with the first question for you, Michelle. I know with Irkut, support was an issue, as it was with the Sukhoi Superjet. Internationally, is there any development of a support and service network for COMAC, for the Belt and Road countries, and for export of C919 to Africa and other places?
Well, you know, they're making a lot of noise about how to be customer-centered. You know, last week during the Innovation Week, it was clearly one of the messages that the chairman of COMAC was sending across. You know, let's be a customer-focused enterprise. Let's focus on performance. Let's focus on support. You know, that's just the message coming from the top. Right now, I think they're working on it. But again, you know, they can learn a tremendous amount from the electric car industry in China. I think we should be prudently optimistic about the Chinese ability to provide support, but we just shouldn't have the expectations that we have with an Airbus, Boeing, or an Embraer. It'll take time, but one thing is certain from a capability standpoint, the electric car industry in China has been able to do customer support. Granted, it's a much more simple system. It's a much more, it's an easier, I would say, logistic infrastructure. But if you take a car company like NIO, NIO, which makes one of the finest SUV, electric SUV in the world, I can guarantee you I've driven one of those. It's absolutely fantastic. The customer support has been the focus of that company and have executed very well. So I think at some point we have to come to terms with the fact that Chinese can do customer support. It's just going to take time.
Agree. Does that present an opportunity for Embraer and the Chinese to work together?
I think the question the answer to that question is not for us to say. I think it says somewhere in that sinister place called Foggy Bottom in Washington, D.C. Joke aside, and I think we addressed that issue early last month during our Embraer webinar, it is clear that COMAC AVIC will not be allowed to further partner with Embraer. I think already you can add to that conversation, to that question, but I'm bluntly saying it's not going to happen. It could, and it perhaps should, but in my mind, it cannot happen.
Yeah, I don't think the United States government would look favorably on that, and that would be a substantial threat to Boeing, because Embraer has just what COMAC needs, which is the ability to integrate technologies, integrate engines and airframes, and a global support network. So I think it would provide them instant credibility, and that's something the U.S. government is probably not going to allow to happen, and would institute sanctions on the engines and other components. But
Major systems integration and support is really an issue with COMAC, and I would say that yes, they would gain. You know, there's a bit of a debate here. I mean, we're such at the relative quote-unquote advanced stage of development for the C919. What would they gain from such an acquisition from a design capabilities, engineering capabilities? A bit of a question mark to me right now, as the first question very correctly pointed out, right now is more towards the future. Can they do product support? Can I really ensure reasonable numbers for the aircraft serviceability and sort of things? That's really the focus, right?
And I think it's that ramp up in capabilities. You know, making 10 aircraft is different from making 100 or 200 or 300 aircraft a year.
I mean, Comac is still me. I mean, a fair point. I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but Comac is still me. You know, their goal initially is 40, 50 aircraft a year. They're not shooting for the moon. And I think that's manageable to them. But beware, once the production system is well oiled and they have the supply chain running efficiently as well, that's when they're going to become very, very dangerous.
Well, we've got the potential to be dangerous for two reasons. One is these are really government-owned entities, so the normal return on investment you would say about growing to 30 or 40 aircraft a year would be infeasible in the West. You just wouldn't have the volume to cover the overheads and the costs, and you'd have to grow quite substantially. In this environment, there's a learning process, there's a long-term goal, a long-term objective, and plenty of funding. So that subsidy and support will keep COMAC going for a long time, as it will for UAC in Russia. So I think there's a difference there in terms of their overall economics in the West. And we've seen Boeing and Airbus go after WTO sanctions. Could they do the same with China and Russia down the road?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we've been writing about this in our analyst note 17, 18, 19 about the risk of exposure of COMAC to what has happened to UAC. And of course, you know, we're not one on this in this format. I think it's a little risky to enter the world of geopolitics, and especially so close to the presidential election. But the obvious risk to COMAC is the engine. And I've already mentioned that. It's the ability of the company downstream to develop and service a Chinese-produced engine. You know, the 606 Institute in Shenyang, and it's a 412 factory. They're heavily, you know, responsible for the development of that engine. But again, in China, there is a will, but there is a priority, and there's a pecking order. The pecking order in China, very much like Russia to a lesser degree, is that the military is going to get the absolute priority from an engineering, from a resources and project management standpoint. The supply chain is very militarily focused for obvious reasons. And even, you know, in its search for talent and capture for talent, you know, COMAC is struggling because commercial aircraft is perceived as not as prestigious as working for Chengdu or working for Xi'an or Shenyang, military companies. And there's a cultural impact there. So, you know, while there has been a lot of effort to work on the WS-20, the engines for the Y-20 strategic airlifters, especially replace the old Soloviev-based model engines, the ACJ-1000 is suffering a little bit from that military prioritization to a degree. And we don't see, I mean, based on information, we don't see a Chinese engine that hits the numbers, not just from a fuel burn standpoint, but especially from serviceability and reliability standpoint. We're about 8 years out from that engine, you know, hitting the numbers. So the question for COMAC and for UAC and the MS-21 is, how do you bridge? What do you do in this uncertain environment? How do you carry on with the development of your industry? And I think that focus on the indigenous supply chain is a step towards that target for 2028.
Let's turn it over to Addison for moderating questions from the audience.
Okay, gentlemen, I actually have a question myself. Just to get this going, if I remember correctly, when Aeroflot put in their order for the MC-21, the first 50 were going to come with GTFs. Now with sanctions, does that mean that Aeroflot will go exclusively to PD-14s? Do we know that?
I think as long as the sanctions are there, the answer has to be yes. It would be PD-14s.
And that probably will delay some of their deliveries. Anyway, first question from the audience. Is the West at risk of becoming an unreliable partner to China, which may lock out Western aerospace companies to the local Chinese market?
Two ways to see that. There's the inevitable, you know, transfer of production and systems to China. It's happening. It's the goal. It's made in China 2025. So that's going to happen. And again, but how do you bridge this? And is there a role for Chinese, for Western manufacturers in the future, you know, with the CR929, and we haven't talked too much about that aircraft, and that's going to come probably in 2027, 2028. You know, the question is, the Chinese are still going to need, like Airbus, you know, let's not forget Airbus relies significantly on U.S. Suppliers. You know, this is a global supply chain. This is a global industry. There is a fair amount of specialization, in particular in engine technologies, as we've seen. So the question fundamentally is what, you know, what is going to be perceived as acceptable risk for the Chinese? I mean, engine we see is kind of like the nuclear weapon of commercial aircraft industry, you know, so they need to have the engine, they need to have the independence with respect to the engine. For the rest, you know, for landing gear, for flight control systems, for avionics, for interiors, of course, and we've seen interiors mostly Chinese right now. But for some other system, I think there's still a role and potential for Western suppliers to play a critical part. Will be very interesting to see what Leonardo decides to do from a structure standpoint with their participation on the CR929 and their assistance that have been provided to COMAC on the development of that fuselage for the 929. Is Leonardo going to fall flat on its face and suddenly realize that they've taught everything they need to teach the Chinese and get nothing in return? I'm not so sure. I think the Chinese are pretty smart about how they go about the relationship with that manufacturer. When you look at the issues that Leonardo has with Boeing these days, and certainly with Airbus, you know, there's a moment in history right now where Leonardo is saying, you know, what is or the potential with these companies? What is the potential with China? What partner can be most reliable? And you start thinking maybe there's an extension of the relationship with Italy and China, and we've seen the Chinese very visible, obviously, during the early stage of the pandemic in Italy with the assistance provided there. This is not an accident. This is, you know, the geopolitical chessboard at play, and clearly there is an engagement of Italy on the part of China that is destined to probably have an impact on where Italy wants to go.
Okay, next question.
With Italy being the only EU country that's a member of Belt and Road and signed onto that to the Chinese cooperation, that could be a lot. But are the opportunities there for U.S. suppliers, or are geopolitics going to block the opportunity for us to? For suppliers here in the U.S. to go after COMAC? And that's the real question.
Can we move on to the next question here from the audience? Do you see any significant regulatory barriers for the flight of the C919 outside of China due to safety concerns by global aviation regulators? How much of an operational history do you think regulatory agencies will seek, if any, before they certify the aircraft?
I think under the system of international reciprocity, there will be a review, and given the MAX situation in the U.S., the EASA has already indicated that it'll take a harder look at the 777X certification process here. So I think there'll be a hard look at certification processes around the world, but China has taken a look at the Western standards and basically said we'll meet those standards and we'll meet and exceed those standards. So I think their testing will be thorough. Their time frames aren't as short as we've had here. I think the certification process will go relatively smoothly because the Chinese are detailed and they will dot every I and cross every T.
All right, next one. How far is Comac AVIC expect to go with developing a Chinese supply base when a Western supply base already exists? Is it parts and commodities, or do they plan to develop their own indigenous systems?
The way I was presented with that effort last year when I was in Shanghai and Xi'an was, we're going to do exactly what we did with the military supply chain. We're going to bring the Chinese industry into play. And there is a will, and there is a push from Beijing to transfer the vast majority of systems of industrial, you know, participation in the C919, CR929 into the hands of Chinese companies. It doesn't matter where they're, done in partnership with Western companies to a degree, but, you know, when you look at what has been done with Aviage and GE, when you look at the JVs that Liebherr and others have in China, it has obviously been very positive for those companies, although Aviage has been a little bit of a struggle and a bumpy road, let's put it this way. But no, there is an absolute push, and this will happen, for a Chinese commercial aerospace supply chain that meets the requirement of Comac for the future. And I think that's in the Chinese mind, that's their measure, that's the only guarantee they can have that their industry is not going to be held hostage to external forces.
All right, next one. Comac seems to already be working on a C919 hybrid. Do you think they can make it happen, and when, or is it just a paper airplane?
Hybrid, the most overused terminology in aviation and in transportation these days, perhaps. I mean, what do we mean by hybrid? C919 aircraft, what would be the value of an hybrid aircraft? I believe more of a carbon footprint reduction exercise when it comes to the reduction throughout the entire supply chain, manufacturing, and the aircraft itself. You cannot rely only on the system, on the aircraft, for decarbonization of the model. So, you know, it happens throughout the supply chain, it happens in the air, it happens all in the fabrication as well. I don't see the 919 to be a good candidate for that. I think the Chinese are probably going to start lower like everybody else. But it doesn't happen until the new 9X9 happens sometimes in the mid 2030s. Their capabilities, but Let's put it this way. The Chinese are very methodical. They're going to get the 919 right before they start playing with it and see what they can do. They're going to get the 929 right, and that's going to be the focus. There's not going to be too much deviation. Of course, they're working on that technology. They're working on hydrogen. They're working on electrification, but that takes time. An A320 is some 737 type. A single aisle aircraft powered by hydrogen doesn't happen until 2040, 2045. So okay. Let's be realistic.
Next question. I'm happy to see we go back to Russia here. Performance is certainly important, but so is environmental compatibility. Has the OEM, I guess that would be UAC, put any emphasis on carbon offsetting for the PD-14?
They have, and they've improved the fuel burn of the PD-14 to actually only 6 to 8% less than the GTF. So it's better than the current set of engines that are out there on the NGs and the Airbus CEOs, and that's an improvement in carbon. Obviously, they've got a way to go to catch the leap in the GTF, but they're not that far behind, and. Given you know, given the emphasis on green in Europe, they're going to be, a positive reduction as they replace older aircraft with new ones, even 737 NGs.
I guess, Ernie, if you think about the PD-14 being, let's say, 6% to 8% less fuel efficient than the GTF, but looking at the price of fuel right now, that fuel advantage is really tiny.
It's not a big advantage, and the environmental numbers are, of course, more important in the European environment where they turn into taxes and fees. So it's important to have that carbon offset, but they're doing their best and they're catching up on technology. They're probably a half a generation behind us at this point and rapidly closing the gap.
Okay, next question is really interesting. Does the CR-929 survive COVID?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, things don't happen like this the same way they might happen in the West with the Chinese. Those are projects that are state, controlled and state oriented projects. They follow a plan to bring more independence to China. The 929 is part of that plan. So, COVID, again, when you look at the development of aviation and high-speed train in China, there are two facts. High-speed train is a very expensive, capital-intensive, means of transportation. It works beautifully. It has a reduced environmental footprint up to a point. But if you go deep into Western China, if you go into the coastal cities as well, you'll see that the population density and city are limiting the further expansion of high-speed train. And really the 929 has a role to play, not only as an international aircraft, but especially as a major hubs to major hubs, transportation tool between the Beijing, Shanghai, Beijing, Hong Kong, Beijing, Kunming, Guangzhou, and all those places where, there are peak times in those hubs that require the deployment of A330, 787 category airplanes. So there is no, I think, doubt in my mind that the 929 plays an integral role, not only from a plan standpoint, from yet another necessary lab aircraft, but also from a requirement standpoint, part of Chinese carriers.
And yet, remember when Airbus came out with the high capacity seating on the 330 for the Chinese market, nobody really bought the plane.
Yet.
Too soon.
Nobody yet.
Yeah. Okay. Next question.
In the Russian market, the 929 will also be effective. And when you look at high-speed rail as an option, replacing the whole Trans-Siberian railway, given the distances in Russia, and a lower density of population than China, make the airplane even more critical to the Russians.
Next question. Please provide more details regarding the structural challenges and delamination issues of the 919 shown on your slide.
Not on this form.
Okay. All right. Next question. Tell me, gentlemen, what do you think the U.S. election impacts are going to look like, depending on who wins? What do you think happens going forward to companies like Comac and UAC?
Well, it's so you're asking us basically what happens if President Trump is reelected, what happens if Vice President Biden is elected?
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. I think we don't want to dwell too much into politics here, but it's all a matter of what the Chinese are going to respond better to in terms of potential sanctions or, this or that. I mean, definitely, I think Comac may be better served with President Trump in power for another 4 years. Because the relationship is going to be very much business centered to a degree, It's going to be very much, you know, buy some Boeing and I'll keep you, your supply of engines going for the time being. They know that the Chinese know that they have to buy, you know, for some time, they have to be patient. So maybe in that regard, there's a more business trade, you know, of opportunity with President Trump. With Vice President Biden, you know, we're entering the realm of uncertainty. Yes, there's going to be a significant, you know, commonality with the Trump trade policy, just applied differently. And I think Biden may be more detrimental to U.S.-Chinese relations in the sense that he's going to emphasize human rights, he's going to emphasize Xinjiang, and you guys are going to emphasize all sorts of things that are bound to irk and upset the Chinese leadership, which may in turn, you know, jeopardize Boeing's chances and the trade relationship more deeply. Of course, you know, you never know. I think we're assuming things and we're not voicing an opinion for this one or that one, but to a degree, what we can be certain of is that the Chinese-U.S. relation is in a transformation phase, a decoupling phase, although we're at the early stages of that decoupling. So I don't know, Ernie, you probably have an opinion on that as well.
I think taking a foreign perspective, the question that comes to play is America a reliable trading partner anymore? Can we rely that we're going to have those supply agreements that we signed with Pratt & Whitney and with CFM, having those engines delivered? Or will political considerations get in the way and cause the trade embargoes and other impacts that and sanctions that at one point in time would be called acts of war if we go back 60, 70 years before World War II with the oil embargo on Japan. So it's a question of can the U.S. be perceived as a reliable trade partner? And I think the more we have switching of policies, the less reliable we seem. So there are arguments to be made on both sides and who's better for which candidate. But I think the overall issue that we need to focus on as a country is can we be trusted globally?
Yeah, I think, Ernie, it's the, you know, issues here. You know, again, I'm repeating myself perhaps, but, you know, the train has left the station. China and to a lesser extent Russia are looking at increasing their independence throughout the supply chain aircraft design and really freeing themselves from as much as possible from U.S. technology, because they know that when their industry, in particular, that applies mostly for COMAC, when their industry becomes a viable competitor, and it happens, you know, in 15 years, it happens later in the 30s, then the full blunt of U.S. sanctions, the way it has been applied to Iran, the way it has been applied to other countries, may come their way. This is hypothetical. But if history serves as an example, what may happen in the future, COMAC is going to look at this and the Chinese government look at it and say, you know what, we better be prepared. There are examples with Western suppliers as well. You know, when you look at French company Dassault Aviation and their excellent Rafale multirole airplane, you see exactly the same pattern of domestic supply chain, basically making sure that your aircraft is as ITAR-free as it can be. So, you know, we've seen recently for Dassault, they had a problem with a small component that goes into a missile on the Rafale that needed to be redesigned because it was a U.S. Component and it needed to be removed in order to export that specific system to Egypt. For COMAC, it's going to follow the same pattern for obvious reasons.
Gentlemen, in the short time we have left, we've got 4 minutes left. Top three issues for each of these companies. Go.
For Irkut, getting around sanctions and getting the domestic model to work. Number one, support network. Number two, if they want to sell outside of Russia. And three, it's basically getting the engine integration and the timetable done, getting the airplane out on time.
I agree with Ernie. I would add just one to that list is really developing the next generation of aerospace leader. You know, Russia is suffering a void in terms of competence, and they need to really bring a new generation and train a generation of future leaders in that sector.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for participating today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Addison.